This episode contains description and discussion of the school shooting that happened in Florida yesterday. Welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin, and today on the pod, we do have an interview for you. I had the pleasure to sit down with Laura Moser, who is running for Congress in Texas's 7th district. She is running against a Tea Party Republican and total dickwad. And we got to sit down and talk about the dangers of a Trump presidency, what Congress can do about it, and why she thinks her district can turn blue, especially because it's been firmly red since 1967. We recorded the interview yesterday before news of the mass shooting in Florida had surfaced. And just by coincidence, we did end up talking about Laura's position on gun control and gun reform.
So I talk about gun violence a lot. There's a lot of, you know, I've been involved in that issue for a long time as a parent and as a writer. And a lot of people in this district, yes, Texas is a gun state. Nobody's trying to take away your guns. But a lot of people think that gun violence is out of control and would like there to be some sensible laws governing who gets to have a gun.
So before we get to that conversation, I am first going to talk about what happened yesterday. I think we all know the story by now, 24 hours later. And it is a story that gets told over and over again. It is a uniquely American crisis that we keep having this conversation. A white man, 19 years old, went into his school and started shooting with a semi-automatic rifle. 17 people are dead as of this recording. It was a white man with a history of domestic violence. Even at a young age, he was abusive towards his 17-year-old ex-girlfriend and was expelled from school following a fight he had with her new boyfriend. That fact alone, that a 17-year-old girl has already suffered abuse from an intimate partner, should send a chill down your spine. But it's not just that. It's that the link between domestic violence and gun violence is so painfully clear, yet we continue to ignore it. Even in the current reporting, we focus on mental health and making guns harder to get and what warning signs were ignored. And those are all conversations we need to have. Make no fucking mistake. We need gun reform now. We need to politicize this until our heads hurt and our hearts ache and until we can't get these images out of our minds. We need to take this and run towards gun reform. And we need to hold our members of Congress accountable in ways that they do not even yet understand. We need to vote them the fuck out and scream until they listen. We need to see our own children, our nieces and nephews, our friends and our friends' kids. And we need to stop pretending that, quote, guns don't kill people. People kill people. Guess what, assholes? Guns kill people. Without guns, we are spectacularly bad at killing each other en masse. I was listening to the Broward County Sheriff's Department, which is Broward County is where the school is located, their press conference last night. And he said that anyone that is dedicated to hurting people can, whether it's with a gun or by ramming a vehicle into a crowd. Way to change the fucking subject to something completely unrelated. How many schools have been run into with cars? I'm sure it's not zero, but it's also not 18 in the first 45 fucking days of 2018. So fucking spare me. Leave me out of that tired ass narrative and grow a spine and give your big old middle finger to the NRA. Because at the end of the day, you as lawmakers, us as a society, we need to be able to look at ourselves in the mirror. Hell, we need to look at our children and the children we know and know that we did the best we could. And if we're still playing patsy to the NRA, if lawmakers are still taking their money in exchange for policy, then we did not do the best we could. They traded money. We traded money for the lives of children, and that should haunt all of us. And there's another layer here. There is a deeper problem lying in wait under the gun reform debate, under the mental health debate, under the lone wolf narrative debate that I'm sure we're going to have. And I'm going to just read the lead to one article from the Boston Globe. They said, quote, the leader of a white nationalist militia says Florida school shooting subject, name redacted because I will not say it, was a member of his group and participated in paramilitary drills in Tallahassee. So that is sentence one. And it just tells us right off the bat that this person was a white supremacist, a white nationalist. And still we refuse to see what is right in front of us. We are in the middle of an immigration debate. And again, as of this recording, we just, the Senate couldn't pass yet another immigration reform package. So this immigration debate has been twisted by Trump into a narrative about terrorism that starts with the travel ban back when he first took office, banning people from seven majority Muslim countries in the name of securing America. We other terrorists in our minds, and we twist immigration to be about protecting Americans' values. But what we fail to recognize is that right now, from where I'm sitting, we are a nation of terrorists. White men are the group most likely to commit acts of terror in this country. Statistically speaking, that is a goddamn fact. From the website Statista, quote, between 1982 and November 2017, 54 out of 95 mass shootings were initiated by white shooters. The Las Vegas Strip massacre in 2017 had the highest number of victims between 1982 and 2017, with 58 people killed and over 500 injured. And lest we forget, the Las Vegas shooting was perpetrated by a, say it with me, white man. Half of all women murdered with a gun in this country are killed by an intimate partner. Domestic violence is a direct line to gun violence, which is in turn linked to the accessibility of guns, which is in turn linked to mass shootings and school shootings and accidental gun deaths and the NRA's vice grip on our elected officials. We are in a moment where the president stood up to defend Rob Porter, a man whose two ex-wives said abused them. And Trump is standing up there lamenting how hard of a time Rob Porter, the abuser, is having. He didn't even bother to play lip service to the victims of domestic abuse or these women in particular or women in general. And honestly, I'm kind of glad. At least he didn't bother trying to convince us that he cares. He himself is a serial sexual predator and abuser. And I am tired of him and everybody around him pretending otherwise. Of course he doesn't care about women. Water wet, sky blue. And from that same Boston Globe interview, it continues, quote, a student also said he had, quote, trouble with a girl and believed the timing of the attack carried out on Valentine's Day wasn't a coincidence. And another student said the shooter had been abusive to his ex-girlfriend and that his expulsion was over a fight with her new boyfriend. So just in case we were unclear on the terms there. I am tired of Trump jumping to the defense of violent white men while decrying black and brown men in the same breath. This is the man who took out a full-page ad in the New York Times to demand the death penalty for the, quote, Central Park Five, who were five young men of color accused of rape and eventually exonerated. But, you know, who cares if they're eventually exonerated? The death penalty was totally the right way to approach that. Though, you know, he did also say that a group of neo-Nazis marching in Charlottesville are mighty fine people. Because with him, it's never about the guilt or the crime. It's about the color of the accused skin. So this 19-year-old white man, a white supremacist, an abuser, he got easy access to a gun and killed 17 people. And there are many ways to talk about this story. And today, I want to remind everyone that this tragedy isn't just a tragedy. It's not pure evil, which is how the sheriff from Broward County in that press press conference kind of referred to it. Two times he called it an act of pure evil. To frame it that way is to completely invalidate what really happened. Because what really happened and what this is really about is it's about the devaluation of women who are abused and about white men whose privilege wraps their misdeeds in this mental illness or evil label to excuse it away. This is about guns and violence and our access to weapons that we have no business having in our hands. It is a systematic failure at every level and our willing ignorance of who is dangerous and why. The Hellion of the Week this week is a woman named Melissa Fikowski. She teaches journalism at the school that was just the attack of a mass shooter. And she remained calm. She had been trained what to do when there was an active shooter at the school. She remained calm. And she got herself and her students into a closet and kept them safe. She is one of the heroes of this story. And something that Mr. Rogers said, and something that a new show by Mr. Rogers that is for kids says, they say when you're anxious and when you read about something like a natural disaster or war or a mass shooting, you should look for the helpers. Look for the people who are helping. Look for the people that are trying to make things okay. And I think that's a really good way to get through some of these really difficult stories, is you can look at the first responders, you can look at the teachers and the people who were there who protected these kids, and you can look at the parents who afterwards stand up and decide that they can't take this shit anymore. You can look at people like fellow Hellion Shannon Watts, who took all of her anger and created a movement and created Moms Demand Action for gun control. And that is definitely a positive way to reframe this. So the Hellion for this week is the helper, Melissa Fikowski, and all of the women and men who were there helping a terrible situation that should never have happened. The Trump administration and this bananas news has me totally stressed out. And my skin will let everyone know if I'm stressed out. That's why I've started using Tula, a skincare company that focuses on taking care of your skin from the inside out. I love Tula because the products are powerful but gentle. I've struggled with acne and uneven skin my whole life, and I'm pretty sure they might be magic because I haven't had a breakout since start using their creams. Tula is made with probiotics and other powerful skin superfoods like vitamin C, blueberry, and flaxseed. And it's like a delicious smoothie for my skin. And they're also among the first to use probiotics, which are at the cutting edge of skincare research. So go to Tula.com/hellbent to try Tula probiotic skincare today. Get 20% off and free shipping on your order with the promo code at the top of the screen. That's Tula, Tula.com/hellbent. And use the promo code on screen for 20% off your Tula purchase and free shipping. That's Tula.com/hellbent. Laura Moser is running to represent Texas's 7th District. She is up against a long-term Republican incumbent. She also founded Daily Action, a text message service that reaches over 300,000 people and encourages them to take daily political action. She is also a best-selling author and a mom to two young children. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you. So good to be here.
Yeah, I am exhausted just reading your bio, let alone living it.
I feel pretty exhausted right now as well.
Yeah.
6 days to go before early voting.
Yeah, I imagine. I want to jump right in and ask you, what made you want to run for Congress?
Well, there's a short answer and a long answer. The short answer is that I never wanted to run for Congress at all. It was never remotely on my radar, but I am the descendant of people who fled Nazi Germany right. and arrived in Houston in the 40s. And I just saw as a student of history, you see what happens when your country is taken over by people that you did not at first take seriously. And I just resolved to do whatever I could to fight for the America I believed in.
Right.
And at first that was daily action. And then when I saw how successful daily action, which I started in my living room with no money and just an idea, when that really took off, I wanted to do more. Slowly and then very quickly morphed into my being a congressional candidate
yeah.
in my home district.
You mentioned in history someone you don't take seriously becoming a serious problem. So what, I'm assuming you're talking about Trump and the Trump presidency. What do you think is the most dangerous thing about a Trump presidency and this administration as it's gone, it's almost a year and a half now?
There are so many. I've actually never been asked that question, and there's a million different possible answers. But I think the largest, kind of most all-encompassing one is how there's no longer anything as truth.
Right.
You know, there's this sort of alternative facts thing. We all live in these really segmented, compartmentalized online universes where we don't really interact with people who have different viewpoints. But there is such a thing as black, white, right, wrong. And that no longer happens because Trump can say one thing and then say the opposite 5 minutes later. And both things are true because he says that. And that, as we know, is how kind of authoritarian regimes begin. And it's frightening to be living in one, the beginnings of one.
I think that's really evident with this Rob Porter and the other staffer who left
right.
the White House from domestic violence allegations, and how they keep changing the story and changing the timeline, and we're just supposed to believe whatever they say is true.
Right. And it doesn't matter what's true anymore, because that's kind of what he's done. He's kind of destabilized the idea of there being truth and fiction.
Right.
You know, it's like the sort of, even this is a leap, but this summer with the Charlottesville riot, like to say they're fine people on both sides,
right,
to equate two groups of people that have nothing in common diminishes us all, you know.
Right. And he kind of created that connection out of nowhere, and we're supposed to take it as truth.
Right.
So what do you think? You're running for Congress, obviously. So what do you think Congress's position in this Trump presidency is? What can Congress do about these dangers?
I mean, you know, we have a really intelligently designed, sophisticated system of government that hinges on checks and balances. And right now, obviously, Republicans control all three branches of government, but we should still have checks and balances. And unfortunately, most of the Republicans in office right now are more concerned about passing a tax cut and undoing the legacy of Barack Obama to really see what's happening to our government and to try to change it. So I think, unfortunately, we will need we need a Democratic Congress to restore checks and balances. And that's what we can do in small ways and big.
What is your main issue? What do you want to focus on day one of your term?
Because I'm running from a district in Houston that has flooded massively three times in the last 3 years. So it would have to be on an infrastructure and spending bill to bring the federal dollars to this district that have consistently been denied us because, in large part, our current representative is a Tea Partier who kind of doesn't believe in the federal government. So there's tons of things I want to focus on, but I think for day one in Houston, I mean, we had 3 inches of rain last week and people's yards kind of flooded. You know, we are not preparing for what's to come. And I think other parts of the country need massive infrastructure investments as well. And that used to be something, you know, that used to be an area of bipartisan. Try what Obama tried at the beginning of his first term, massive,
right,
you know, infrastructure stimulus spending.
What do you think of Trump's quote-unquote infrastructure plan?
I am disappointed in it. We have these states that are already so stressed for revenue, and many of them even worse so after the tax bill. I think that we need actual federal investment in infrastructure. We cannot put everything on the states.
He's also, from what I understand in this plan, if you want to call it that, he's actually taking money from existing infrastructure programs and repackaging it and not really investing
money. And not actually
money.
Adding any... Right.
Right.
So that's a disappointment because he campaigned on this, you know, and a lot of people there's a lot of good jobs in investing in infrastructure. And obviously there's safety issues and remaining a first world. He's the one who always says we live in a third world country because of our infrastructure. We have some really bad infrastructure in this country and strained, and it could be dangerous. And that's actually something that I hoped they would spend some money on.
Right.
But this doesn't seem to be a step in that direction.
Right. You mentioned that the person you're running against, the incumbent, is John Culberson, and he's kind of a caricature from what I can see of this Tea Party anti-science, anti-abortion, anti-everything. And this seat was George H.W. Bush's seat, and it's been Republican since 1967. So why do you think it would flip now?
So this has always been a Republican district. It was redistricted in the 66 to become, you know, before it was a Democratic seat, but it was nowhere near this part of the state. So it's a Republican district, but it is, you know, you mentioned George H.W. Bush, who was the first representative of this district. He has very little in common with John Culberson. There's like the Country Club Republican and then the Tea Party Republican. George H.W. Bush was actually a great leader of stuff like climate legislation and immigration reform. And yes, he wanted to lower the capital gains tax rate, but he was a reasonable, intelligent, compassionate person. And John Culberson, this is a 68% college educated district. People in this district are worried about their kids' jobs. They're worried about whether we'll survive the next storm. They're not thinking about 6-week abortion bans.
Right.
And John Culberson's also really obsessed with interstellar travel and kind of finding life. And that's just not, we have problems on this earth in this time that need to be tackled. So I would say that he is, the one reason this is a winnable district is because he's so out of keeping with the people in this district. And also it has to be said that Hillary Clinton did win this district.
I think interstellar travel gets the award for weirdest policy I've heard.
Yes.
He wants to celebrate
the 100-year anniversary of the landing on the moon with a trip to Alpha Centauri.
Wow. I'm kind of surprised that he doesn't deny the moon landing or something with everything else I've read about him.
He only denies what NASA finds, which is that climate change is real. He loves science, and I mean, he loves outer space in that kind of way that my son, you know, we were talking about dinosaurs before.
Right.
One of the great findings of NASA is that the sea levels are rising and something is happening that we need to deal with right now on this earth, but that he dismisses that.
It's an odd position.
He likes the sci-fi kind of. Yeah, he likes the
sci-fi side of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I also like sci-fi, but I'm not a politician, so that's fine. You've also been very outspoken about the fact that Democrats failed to use their leverage to get a DACA fix attached to the must-pass spending bill. So in your opinion, how could they have handled that differently? How would you have approached that situation?
Well, you know, that's a really good, difficult question. And I do not claim to be an expert seasoned legislator, but I do know that we don't have much leverage. I'm the first to admit that, right?
Right.
Again, minority party. I'm very confused at what Democrats are doing. I thought Nancy Pelosi was so badass when she stood up there in her 4-inch heels for 8 hours, presumably to tie the budget to some sort of bill to protect the Dreamers. And then that budget passed without any DACA element. And then she says she's glad it passed because they gave away the store. So I just don't quite understand what we can do, but I think we need to have a more unified vision of the possibility.
Would you agree that they're sort of fracturing in the Democratic Party? This is a really hot take that a lot of people love to talk about. Do you think that this is an indication that the Democratic Party needs to reunify in some ways?
Yeah, I mean, it's not just reunify. We need to have a come to Jesus moment about what we stand for and who we are and who we're fighting for. You know, as a person running in a primary election with different types of Democrats, who are we in this for? Are we nicer than Republicans, but essentially the same as Republicans, or do we actually stand for the values of the majority of Americans? And I really believe that the National Democratic Party is kind of out of touch with what some people on the ground want. Right. And I believe that we would win more elections if we had a more coherent platform. But it's hard. It's very hard.
Right. It is. It's, you know, especially a 50-state strategy. I mean, there's a lot of different people, a lot of different states.
Right. Whereas Republicans are just trying to appeal to a small group of people, and they have the red meat that they can toss. And if you don't have the kind of dog whistles available to the current GOP, and again, I am not talking about the George H.W. Bush GOP. I'm talking about the number of people in this country and in this district who felt he'll feel very left behind by what's happening with Donald Trump's party.
You mentioned the infrastructure and that being a big issue for you. Would you say that that is the main issue that affects people in Texas 7, or is there something else that really isn't being addressed?
Yes, that is the main issue. I mean, tens of thousands of people are still not in their homes in this district, and the future of Houston really hangs in the balance right now. Healthcare is another big issue. Obviously, Texas is the most uninsured state in the nation. Houston is the most uninsured city in that state. It's a huge drain on, I mean, even if you don't care about the moral aspects of letting people, you know, die of cancer in the emergency room, there are economic consequences that people here are very concerned about. And again, this is a Republican district. People care about the fact that we are not getting taxpayer money for Medicaid expansion. And John Culverson, he's like top front of the line whenever there's an opportunity to repeal the Affordable Care Act. But actually, we need money. We need federal investment. We need transit, you know, expansion, and we just don't get it. So those are the three. Healthcare, transit, infrastructure are definitely the three main issues. I talk about gun violence a lot. There's a lot of, you know, I've been involved in that issue for a long time as a parent and as a writer. And a lot of people in this district, yes, Texas is a gun state. Nobody's trying to take away your guns, but a lot of people think that gun violence is out of control and would like there to be some sensible laws governing who gets to have a gun or just background checks. I mean, so I also talk about background checks because I don't think that that's controversial.
Although again, in this, yeah, this day and age when, well, and you'd think with background checks, the whole Rob Porter thing, the person who had to leave the White House because of domestic violence allegations. I mean, he had a background check and it didn't seem to matter. So you'd think it'd be controversial. So I want to switch gears and talk about Daily Action. You said you started it in your living room, and it now reaches 300,000 people. What was the impetus for it?
I don't run it anymore.
Okay. So what was the purpose when you first created it?
So the purpose was for people like me who felt completely at sea and overwhelmed by the implications of, you know, what a Trump presidency would mean after 8 years of having a presidency, a president I loved and admired for all his human flaws. So I felt like on my social media networks, people were just flailing around saying, sign this petition, ban the Electoral College, you know, call this, do this, march here. But there was just sort of an incoherence to what the instructions were and what we could actually achieve. So I had the idea of doing one thing a day because I have a background as a writer and journalist. And if you could just give people one thing to do a day in under 5 minutes, then we might make some change and we would certainly feel better in the process. And that was it. So call to say thank you for asking for a Russian investigation to the Republican senators. Call, you know, to say we do not want Steve Bannon on the National Security Council. We do not want Betsy DeVos to head the Department of Education. You know, all these things and many battles, obviously, we lost because we don't have the power. But to just get people to wake up and realize that democracy is, as they say, not a spectator sport. And I know so many people who have, and including me, who had never called their representatives before because government is something that happens in these wood paneled rooms far away from us.
Right.
But actually, no, these people are answerable to us and they work for us. And eventually I decided rather than just calling every day, I would also try to change people who answered the phone because John Culverson, Ted Cruz, John Cornyn, they don't care what you say.
It's obvious what spurred this sort of resistance movement and the spark of getting people involved in democracy. What do you think has really sustained this, though?
Well, you know, that's a good question. There's been a lot I mean, I would say around April and May, I spoke with a bunch of other people who are running resistance organizations, and we experienced what was called, I mean, what we called resistance fatigue, where you have 50,000 people calling, and then all of a sudden you're lucky to have 7,000 people calling, because you keep losing. And in the face of these losses, it's hard to get up in the morning and keep calling. And now I think what's sustaining it is the imminence of the midterm. My primary is, you know, in 20 days. Mm. So that's very soon. But, like, we can see the light at the end of the tunnel. And the hopelessness and fear of November 9th, 2016 has receded a little, because everything is just as bad as we thought. But we have a chance to really make some real changes. And that's what, I mean, I'm really proud that in my congressional campaign, I have donations from all 50 states. All of these slippable districts have become national causes. So keep our eye on the prize. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Kind of having that goal or that endpoint. So it's not just this I'm resisting forever feeling. It's like I'm doing something and then the next thing will come up, but you at least have manageable chunks.
And how to sustain it after November, especially if we don't get the House, is another question.
Right.
Because these districts are not easy. I mean, I will say this district I'm running in, everyone pinned so many hopes on it, and it's totally flippable, but it's not going to be easy. But then Doug Jones was a bright spot. The other lesson from that is that rather than just carpet bombing people's mailboxes and flooding the airwaves with meaningless commercials, my campaign is focused on voter contact. And that's what Doug Jones, that's what they just did such a brilliant job at.
Right.
And they got out the vote, and that's how it works, you know? Sometimes the old-fashioned tricks work the best.
Right. And they really got the Black community involved in that campaign, yeah, too, which I think was a very important piece to him winning that election in general. What is something that you wish more people would pay attention to?
Nationally?
Yeah, nationally, in your district. What's something that doesn't get the coverage that you think it should?
That's such a good question, because there's also a million answers to that. I would say, as a former education reporter, writing about schools is not super sexy,
right,
but I think we should be paying attention to what Betsy DeVos is doing at the Department of Education.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Because there were so many phone calls generated just on her day after day after day after day. And I think the reason is because, you know, I'm a mother. My oldest kid goes to public school. My daughter's not quite old enough. But everyone knows what it means not to have ever entered a public school, not to have ever attended one, not to have sent your child there. And people were right to be scared. And it felt personal to them. But I don't hear about the stuff that they're doing quietly as much as I would like to, because it's just really important.
I agree. There's so much in any given news cycle. And then you get things like this Rob Porter thing that just dominates everything. It can be hard to remember some of the finer, less sexy things that also need coverage.
Right. And our lack of investment in education is one reason why we have, frankly, Donald Trump as our president.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. The sort of anti-intellectualism. Kind of on the same vein, what is something that you wish more people would ask you about? I'm sure you do a lot of interviews. You're on the campaign trail. What is something that people never ask?
So I just wrote a thread on Twitter about this last night, because it's something I've been thinking about a lot. I'm a mother of a 5-year-old and an 8-year-old. There are very few mothers of young children in Congress, and I often get asked about the limitations of what being a mother is in a way that obviously no father would ever get asked.
Right.
But I wish people would ask, like, why it's better to be this kind of multitasking person who's managing all these different schedules. You know,
right,
what benefits there are to being a working mother. That's just something I was writing about last night, because we always hear, I'm a Democrat, I'm running, I'm applying for endorsements from Democratic organizations, and the number of people ask me what my child care arrangements will be,
wow,
is just gobsmacking. Wow. You know?
Really?
Yeah. And I say, I'm just curious, have you asked the dads? You know, would they say, oh, yeah, we ask a lot. Oh, really?
No, because
no one ever asked my husband how he managed his career. But kind of, I think I'm like an incredibly efficient person because I am managing household, you know, obviously with a lot of help from my husband and my parents. But what are the benefits of, why do we need more moms in Congress? And we saw, or just compassionate people in general, because if you look at Trump's budget, like the cuts that he has made to basic, you know, safety net programs, I don't think many mothers would approve.
Right.
You know?
No, it's true.
Trying to say that $1.40 a meal is too much,
yeah,
for SNAP benefits.
Or the fact that it took months to get CHIP renewed, which the C in CHIP is for children. And I'm not really sure how it was politically viable to leave that hanging for, what, 6, 7, 8 months? I don't get it.
Yeah.
I'm also a mother. Right. So that just to me was so vile. I think that was my, I was angriest about that. So
you should be. We have to stay angry. Yeah.
Laura, last, we like to ask all of our guests for a gratitude check. We live in dark political times, as we just discussed. So what is something that you're grateful for?
Well, that is a great question. Because it is Valentine's Day, I will say that I am grateful to my husband, mm-hmm. who is a true feminist. The first 8 years of our marriage as parents, I really took the lead on everything. And he has seamlessly transitioned into being the primary caregiver. And I think it's just so amazing for my kids to have a dad with an important job who also figures out what's going in the lunchbox the next day.
Right.
So I'm very grateful. We're having a very unromantic Valentine's dinner with, you know, our kids, but I haven't been able to have dinner with my kids in weeks. So I'm just grateful for my family and their support in this endeavor.
Yeah, I love that. It's so important to have
and my little kitties. Now I have two cats with me.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, I'm a big animal.
I won't tell you how many I actually have, but there's two with me right now.
I know. I'm a big animal lover. I have two dogs and two cats, and I love them.
Yes.
Yes.
They're the best. They make loving so easy.
They do. Oh, it's so good. Well, thank you, Laura, for joining us. Thank you. I know you have a busy schedule, so thank you. You can follow Laura at LC Moser, and you can get involved with her campaign at moserforcongress.com.
Yes, and tonight, I don't know when this is airing. Probably not tonight, right?
Tomorrow morning, yeah.
This is airing. Oh, well. Our fundraising deadline is tonight because we are the first in-country primary. Please, we need phone bankers. We need, wherever you are, you can help flip this district blue. We would love your help.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you again so much for joining us. This has been a great conversation. Very illuminating.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Talk to you again, I hope.
Yes.
All right.
I'll talk to you when you're a congresswoman in Texas 7.
I love it. I love it.
All right. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye. Okay, Hellions, that does it for us today. I hope you enjoyed the interview with Laura Moser. She was fantastic to talk to, and I hope that everyone goes out and calls the representatives and tells them that we need common sense gun reform and we need to recognize terrorists for who they are. And with that, I leave you for the weekend. Have an excellent weekend. Thank you for listening, and we will see you back here with Drexel on Monday.